So here we are together, and whether you're an observer or a participant, you have a potential to notice the space between any two thoughts. Between any two thoughts, there's space, even if it's only this much space. And if you can notice that space, if you can fall into that space, there's your enlightenment. So enlightenment is not some fancy deal that we get later. By falling into the space between any two thoughts, regardless of how fast the thoughts are going, regardless how fast the train is going, that's enlightenment. That's your stillness. And that's immeasurable. That can't be measured. You want to measure it, you want more of it. So maybe if you sit longer, or maybe if you quit sitting entirely because it's too much pain. So that's what this is about. That's what this, we're honoring him, honoring ourselves. And he talked about, after he had this experience and then began teaching, he talked about the four immeasurables. That is, it can't be measured. When we fall into just a little bit of stillness, it's not something we can grab onto, because the stillness is always available. And when we grab onto it, it's not stillness anymore. It's just our idea of stillness. It's not a live stillness, it's stillness in a can. Well, stillness as a can is not what this is about. It's our own heart that this is about. It's our own life that this is about. So we have the four immeasurables that he talked about. And he said, we think he talked about them. You know, the Pali scriptures were written, it was an oral transition, so tradition and transition. So we don't even really know, but apparently he talked about the four immeasurables. Apparently he talked about equanimity, loving kindness, compassion, and joy. And he said that those are a manifestation of the stillness, but they're also a practice that evokes the stillness. So equanimity, the first one, equanimity. We just get our butts on the floor for 5 minutes or 50 minutes or 7 days. And our dharma container, we call our bodies our dharma container, because they contain the possibility for just noticing and appreciating great silence in ourselves and others. So we get our dharma container on the floor and sit and see what happens. And of course, judgments come in, prejudices come in, preferences come in, ups and downs, and a little bit of steadiness, and more ups and more downs, and a little bit of steadiness. As we do this, we begin to experience some resilience, some ability just to be with whatever. Whatever drama is going on. Whatever sloth and torpor or boredom is going on. Just to be with it. Without messing with it. Just to be with it. With our open heart. Our open heart. And this is referred to as Manjushri's practice. Manjushri, this bodhisattva up here that I've been talking about in all Zen centers. Well, I can't say all Zen centers, but in all traditional Zendos, this guy is up there on the altar because he's the archetype of equanimity. He practices meditation, and he practices meditation by has a sword in one hand that cuts through all of our crud. And we don't cut through it violently. We cut through it by just paying attention to it lovingly and non-judgmentally, whatever comes in. Just paying attention to it with your open heart, with your still heart, with no judgment, no trace of judgment. You can all do it. You've done it before. You can do it again. It's not rocket science. It just takes practice. His sword in one hand and his Prajnaparamita Sutra in the other hand. Those are turning words. We need some words to help us, to turn us. Sometimes this word that I say helps you, sometimes it doesn't help you at all. Then you hear someone else say something kind or say something that helps you come back to just stillness. And that turns you. So turning words, we'll turn you back toward the little bit of stillness that's between any two thoughts. It's actually a huge stillness, even though it only lasts this long. It's infinite. It's infinite. And you can access it at any time. At any time. So that's the first one, equanimity. The more we practice equanimity through our meditation, the more we begin to be able to be with whatever life gives us. Life is just cruising through, doing its own thing. It doesn't follow our program. We've got a good program. It just cruises through. Can we let that? Can we do that? Can we practice equanimously? That's a big word, isn't it? Equanimously. Ooh, I went to college. Buddha went to college. Well, Buddha didn't go to college. Well, I don't know. Equanimously. Calmly. Calmly, that's all. Calmly. And there's always that calmness potential. If we just sit down and breathe it, if we just look at the sky and breathe into it, if we just take a little walk in the snow, just a 2-minute walk, and notice the snow, notice the trees, notice the birds, even this time of year, a few birds around, you know, a few birds around. So the next one is loving kindness, loving kindness. Doesn't discriminate between those who are naughty and those who are nice. Doesn't discriminate. Loves the naughty ones as much as the nice ones. Right? Doesn't discriminate. The warmth just radiates when we do loving kindness. We do these things consciously too. I mean, they come out of stillness, but they evoke stillness. So we need to do them consciously. Maybe the equanimity practice isn't working for us, so we just do a loving kindness practice. That's cool. We don't have to say there's one true way. There's no one true way. This is the one true way, but what is this? What is this one true way? It's this, but what is it? So loving kindness. So he's got the clock here. Because, what was it, yesterday I talked for an hour and a half, or the day before?
Probably both.
Oh, really? So, loving kindness. So, a few years ago, I was taking a plane to Milwaukee to meet with some other Dharma teachers, and because I was not equanimous, not calm, I missed my plane because I was frantic around. And so I missed my plane. And they were having a dinner, which I missed. And in those days, I didn't have a cell phone. Now I'm in the 21st century, but in those days, I was still way, way back in time. So I couldn't call him, so I was pretty anxious. And I just went up to the counter and talked to the woman at the counter, and she acted like I was her lost and confused son. I didn't know who she was. She just said, "Oh, you missed your plane. I'm so sorry." And I just thought, she's sorry that I missed my plane? She must be 1,000 people. But I felt her heart opening up to me. I felt her heart. And just that feeling, her heart, when she said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I'll see what I can do for you." She said, "There are several different airlines. I'll see what I can do for you." And I had about a 3-minute interchange with her, and she got me on a plane a couple hours later. But it changed my mood entirely. It changed my mood entirely. A few words of loving kindness can change your mood entirely. So when I showed up at that dinner, I was I was so happy to see all those people, I didn't even know them, because of the vibe that she passed on to me with her loving kindness. Did she get paid more for being nice to me? I don't think so. She was just a Buddha and she didn't know it. The best kind of Buddha is one who doesn't know it. Best kind of Buddha is the one who doesn't know it. Because they really do it from their hearts then, not from some thing they're trying to, you know, be good, be nice about. And so, often it's not till afterwards that we realize this, the impact a little gesture of loving kindness can have on our whole day, even on our whole week. The third one is compassion. I'm trying to move along, Bouchon. Ooh, you're supposed to be my student still. Aren't you?
Yes.
Compassion. So, equanimity, calmness, and loving kindness create the context for compassion. They create the context to really be compassionate. And compassion without a little bit of equanimity and a little bit of loving kindness usually don't work. You and I talked about this yesterday. I'm just not going to talk about it today. But they usually don't work. They're usually kind of dry, kind of brittle. And they involve some anxiety about whether the person's okay. Maybe some self-involvement. So this example I was giving yesterday, the day before, was my teacher Suzuki, when his student Trudy had cancer, he just made a place for her in the Zendo. We call this a Zendo, you guys, a meditation hall, with a chair, with a comfortable chair. And then when her cancer got worse, he made a more comfortable chair for her and welcomed her. And just was with her, did stuff with her, went to visit her family in Montana, did stuff with her. But he did it without being all anxious about how she was doing. Just to be there with her, just to join with her, not to be all anxious about it. Because for years he'd been practicing sitting, equanimity, and loving kindness. So he was able to do it. But we can't always do it all the time. We are not superheroes. But this compassion that we can practice has nothing to do with sentimentality, politeness, Minnesota niceness. It allows us to be present with people in their pain. Just to be present with people in their pain without getting all revved up ourselves. We can't always do this, and when we can't do this, we need to go back to just our sitting or our loving kindness practice. So when Hurricane Katrina came, I had already had a bad week and a bad day, and I turned on the television and I watched about Hurricane Katrina, and then I turned it off, and I didn't pay attention to it anymore. And that's because I was exhausted in my life. I was exhausted from kind of being there for others, and so I wasn't in a frame of mind to be compassionate, and I had to accept that. We have to accept that we're not perfect. I had to accept that, and I had to just then practice loving kindness toward myself. Don't leave yourself out, everybody. Half the people I talk to that I try to mentor in Zazen leave themselves out. Loving kindness has to begin with yourself. This practice is not easy, this practice. It just looks like we just sit down, but any of you who try just sitting down know that it ain't easy. So I had to practice loving kindness to myself. And then I was ready, after I'd done that for 3 or 4 days, to go back to watching and thinking and seeing whether I could do anything to help. On Katrina, all I did was send a little money and did a little crying, but that's good. But I needed to shut down and go back to equanimity practice and loving kindness before I was ready. And sometimes you're not ready at all. That's okay. Loving kindness practice is immeasurable, Equanimity is practice is immeasurable, so you don't need to measure by, oh, how much of this am I doing, how much of this, oh, I'm not doing the compassionate. But this is immeasurable. That's what he discovered, immeasurability. That's what we discover. In that tiny little space between two thoughts, 1,000 thoughts, all out of control. Just a little space. That's where it is. That's where your heart is. That's where your openness is. That's where your love for yourself and others is. It's not framed. It's not based on your culture. It's before that, which means right here. Right here. And the fourth one is joy. The fourth immeasurable is joy. Sometimes we have a good day, sometimes we have a bad day. Sometimes we have a good sitting, sometimes we have a bad sitting. We've been doing a lot of sitting here. Sometimes half of the sitting is bad, half of it is good. Right? On and on and on. Okay. That's life, up and down, in and out. But this joy that happens when we settle into the immeasurable is not based on anything. It's not contingent on anything. It's always there, even when we have a bad day, even when we have a bad moment. It's not fabricated. It's not part of culture. It's not part of mind. It surrounds and is embedded in. And when we have a little space between our thought, we see, we feel this joy, this deep joy. So, story in Buddha's life is Buddha and Ananda. Ananda means joy, for those of you who don't know. And Ananda was Buddha's attendant, just like Anne is my attendant. She's been my attendant all week, taking care of my all my bizarre needs as I try to teach. My needs for special foods, because I'm trying to follow my doctor. I hate following my doctor, but I'm trying. So Ananda was with Buddha for a long, long time, his attendant, and had a very, very good memory, and so remembered everything that Buddha said. Supposedly, you know, this is just the deal, the myth, right? Remembered everything Buddha said. It was an oral tradition. Remembered it all said. Then Buddha dies. Well, then they're going to have their first council. They're going to get together, everybody. And now Buddha's dead, and they're going to decide how to practice their zazen, how to practice their meditation, based on what Buddha... But Ananda's the only one who has it in his head. But Ananda has had no experience of enlightenment. The other monks have, but Ananda hasn't. He's been too busy taking care of his friend and teacher to even have 1 minute to do zazen. You ever had that experience where you're so busy you don't even have 1 minute to do zazen? See, people seem to have that experience more and more. When I was young, people had lots of time to do zazen. Of course, we were in the counterculture. Nobody's in the counterculture anymore, maybe one or two people. So we had lots of time. Now nobody has any time. So you must be able to empathize with Ananda, right? So he had no time because he would... So they didn't know. They wanted to have the first council without him, but they basically had no teaching to talk about. So they... So what are they going to do? Well, Ananda went and then started doing his meditation. There are different stories. He went in a little hut and he meditated. And some say he meditated for 1 day, and some say for 3 days, and some say for 5 days, and some say for 7 days, and some say for 10 days, you know. And of course he meditated just like we're meditating, right? Obviously. And he had his crazy mind just like we do, right? And finally, after however many days it was, he was just exhausted. And he kind of just let go. He kind of just completely let go. And what happened? He experienced a little space between his thoughts as he was putting his head on the pillow. And he had an awakening to the great stillness. So then he was able to go to the first council and tell everybody what Buddha had taught, and they
And then they all memorized it, and here we are today, or something like that. Something like that. You can do it any way you want, but that's the way that I've learned it. So joy, joy. We have a natural joy within us. That's what he experienced, Ananda, and that's what we can experience, which is not dependent on anything. It's not dependent on anything. It's a well that never runs dry. And any time we experience a little space, we can feel that joy flooding our being, flooding our friends, flooding the plants and animals around us. Flooding, flooding. So, my teacher Suzuki Roshi was one of the earliest generation of Zen teachers, who came to this country from Japan. But there was actually one generation before him, and there was a guy named Nyogen Senzaki who came before him. And Nyogen Senzaki came to this country to show people how to practice sitting meditation and settle into silence. And of course, nobody was interested at first, so he became a dishwasher. He washed dishes. And he was a dishwasher for quite a while. Then a couple of people began realizing, oh, this guy came from Japan, he's a Zen master. I thought, oh, master. And he said, no, I'm just a dishwasher and I sit in meditation. But they didn't believe him, because when they were with him, they felt something. They felt something. Something still, something available, something open. They felt it. So they started practicing with him. So he is known for many things, but he is known for one thing in particular, his statement, "My gladness is your gladness. I have no other gladness than this. My gladness is your gladness. I have no other gladness than this." So through our wholehearted practice of just one of these immeasurables, we can open up to great stillness, which is not a big deal. It's just being here with each other, just ministering to each other and not leaving ourselves out. Don't leave yourself out. That way we enlighten ourselves, we enlighten all beings. Not of some special experience, but we just lighten up. Everything lightens up. The darker it gets, the lighter it is, because we just open to the center. We just open to the center. And I didn't go too bad. How'd I do?
Perfect.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh. You think he's just kissing butt? I don't mind. He can kiss all the body. Excuse me. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your practice, and happy Buddha's Enlightenment Day, and happy your own settling in to the stillness that you have. It's your precious little pearl. It's hidden in that oyster, and all the sand inside that oyster makes you think it's not there. But if you're just there with the sand, if you just minister to the sand, you'll begin to experience the pearl, and you won't maybe, but other people will know. Will. You don't need to experience it. Other people do. Then it's pretty cool.